Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Neely. This is one in a series of special shows celebrating the 25th anniversary of Peach Pit Press. Joining me for this program is Scott Kelby, a photographer, designer, and author of more than 50 books. Scott's book, The Digital Photography Book, Volume 1, is the best-selling book ever on digital photography. That's quite an accomplishment, especially in this age of photos everywhere. In 2010, Scott became the number one best-selling author across all photography books. He's also the recipient of the prestigious Benjamin Franklin Award, and he joins us now on the program. Welcome, Scott.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks.
I'm so glad you could join us for this celebration of Peach Pit Press.
I am honored to show for anything that Peach Pit does. They're my publishers. I love them.
Yes, you have to, right? So let's start. You've made such an amazing career out of not just your authorship, but you know, looking into all of the training that you provide. Let's start at the very beginning. When and how did you get into photography and or design? Bring us back to the beginning.
Okay, well, the very beginning, I was, I guess I was a film photographer first. So back in the old days, back before you were born, I'm sure, we used to use film. So I was a film photographer, and my brother was really into photography, and he kind of got me sucked into it. And I was just really, really into it, and I wound up at one point starting a studio with a friend of mine who we had regular day jobs because, of course, we had to make a living. But then we started a studio on the side, and I was just shooting. And then I kind of got to a point where literally I got burned out on it. I
really?
Was so kind of just over the top about photography that I literally took all of my studio gear, all of my camera gear, all the stuff that I spent thousands of dollars back when thousands was a lot of money, and
yeah.
I put it up in my attic.
It
for
still
like
is for newbies.
12
so.
Years. No, it is. No, I was, but back then, of course, I didn't buy it all in one time. I amassed it over years, and
absolutely.
I put it all in my attic, just left it up there, and walked away. And I shot a basically disposable film camera for the next 10 or 12 years. And it wasn't until the next time I picked up my first real digital camera that it completely reignited my passion. And now, of course, I'm just psychotic about it. But I realized one of the things that kind of burned me out on the old photography was this: I have the attention span of a hamster. So if I have to wait like an hour to see what I took, it drives me insane. And so
that tells us a little about your workflow then.
Yeah, it does. So anyway, so that's kind of what got me, made the transition back to that. In the meantime, when I was kind of floundering around not being a photographer, I wound up, I was an investment advisor for a bank for a number of years, and I left that to start my own graphic design firm. And so my wife and I opened a very small kind of boutique place, and our niche was we were providing graphic design to advertising agencies that weren't quite big enough to have their own in-house art department. So we would be their art department.
And I got it.
So we would host their meetings in our offices. We had cool offices. That was the one thing we did do. We got lucky and got some really cheap rent on some cool offices. And my wife has a great, great flair for design. So we had really cool offices. And so I wound up having to write copy there, and that's kind of where I learned to write. And then that was where I was introduced to Photoshop, which was back at Photoshop version 2.0. And I learned Photoshop because I was sending. We were doing a magazine for boating, and it wasn't a magazine. Sorry, it was a newspaper. And I was sending all the photos out to be shot with a stat camera, and they would come back just so awful. And so a friend of mine one day, I was like, "Man, I hate the way the photo. You can see the dots on them; they're terrible." And they said, "Hey, you should use Photoshop." I'm like, "What's Photoshop?" And the first time I saw it, that was it. I was all in. And I struggled with it for a while, and then the best $50 I've ever spent in my life was I hired a consultant. My friend and I hired a consultant. It was $100 for him to come in for 2 hours. We used $50 a piece and brought him in to show us all the questions we had in Photoshop. The big one was how to use the pen tool. And when he left, that was it. And so I was off and running. So that's kind of the short version of how it all came about. And so I'll tie it back to today.
Mm-hmm.
The boating magazine went right out of business. I was just laying it out. I wasn't financially involved. But the guy that was said, man, we ought to start another magazine. And I said, well, you know what I'd love to start? I would like to start a magazine about Macintosh computers. Because, and this was what my whole company today, with 90 employees, is based on. We thought we could start a successful Macintosh newspaper. We could get free software to evaluate. We thought, man, that would be the dream because we get to review software that we normally would not be able to buy. So,
right.
And that's what happened. I mean, in short order, we were getting all kinds of people sending us free software. We were thrilled. We thought this is the dream.
Promise
but then
plan.
It's hard to make money on a newspaper or a magazine, as we learned in about 5 or 6 issues. So that's when we came up with the idea. It's a long story that I won't bore you with, to do seminars. And then so in October of 1993, we did our first seminar at the Tampa Convention Center. We charged $59, I think $60 to come. And we had 100 and something people. And that's it. We finally found a way to use the magazine to make money because that's what we do. We advertised in the magazine. And so now we do about 80 seminars a year in the United States, in Canada, and we're going to next week. I'm off to Cologne, Germany, and Amsterdam for my first European ones. We've done them in the UK, but this is our first time in Germany and then Amsterdam. So, but that all started in 1993 with us, you know, doing a low price seminar based on our free magazine that we gave out at CompUSA.
That's fantastic, and you're also an early adopter to videocasts or podcasts with video for those that are not as familiar. But, you know, you've got some traditional, some really lovely production values. You want to talk a little bit about the two shows you're involved in?
Oh, sure. Now, I have to tell you, we actually started, so we do Photoshop User TV is one. I'm actually involved in 3, Photoshop User TV. So
mm-hmm.
Photoshop User TV has been around years. It started as Photoshop Radio. So it was an audio podcast before iPods and things had video in them. So it was, and we would describe to people, we'd go, okay, picture this. Picture a picture. You know, it was not fun to do Photoshop Radio. But we would give tips and little shortcuts and stuff, but it was always a challenge to find a way to make a radio show on Photoshop.
That's pretty cool, actually.
It was. So when video finally came around, I'll never forget it. We were sitting in a meeting and we were like, hey, we should make Photoshop Radio, Photoshop TV, because Apple's doing this thing with iTunes and all this. And it was just all brand new. And we were sitting in this meeting and I was with Matt Kluskowski and Dave Cross, who are my co-hosts still to this day on the show. We met with the marketing people and we went into a bunch of meetings and they were starting to put together flow charts and we're thinking, oh man, this is going to be forever. And so I walked into Dave and Matt's office and I said, guys, I'm going to throw something by you. We could wait until this goes through marketing, until everybody approves it, or we can do one Friday. Which do you want to do? And they looked at me and they said, let's do it Friday. So our first issue, our first episode was horrible. Just ghastly. It was shot in my office. We stood up against the wall. I have a monitor mounted on my wall. We stood against the wall, and our one video person at that time, she hates being a cameraman on a level that cannot be measured on any kind of scale.
Mostly
because
she's
woman.
Female and she can't be a cameraman.
She does not. Well, yeah, she did not want to be a camera person, and so she shot and yelled at us the whole time. And we got it out, and for whatever reason, it just, like, took off. I think it's because there was so little content back then. And so for quite some time, we were like the number one video technology podcast in like every iTunes country in the world. We'd be number one in France, number one in Germany, number one in Amsterdam and all. And, of course, then after a while, all the big players came in, and now you have broadcasts from ABC and NBC and CNET and Discovery Channel, and now we've dropped down. We're still in the top 100. In fact, I posted that on my blog the other day, that we're still in the top 100 podcasts of all video podcasts on iTunes after all this time, even competing with all those big shows. But, that's how that kind of started. I also do 2 other shows. We do a weekly show every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern called The Grid. And there we don't teach. We just talk about photography, and it's usually, you know, a topic that's got everybody all upset that week, because every week on Facebook and Twitter somebody's upset about something. So we talk about what everybody's upset that week, and it goes for about an hour. The idea was to make it short and sweet, but it never, ever is. And we take people's questions on Twitter, so they can just send us a question. They come up live on the air. We read them and address them as we go. And then we also do D-Town TV, which is a weekly camera tip show. So it's nothing but camera tips. And Matt and I started it. We did it for four seasons. And now we've turned it over to RC Concepcion and Larry Becker, who work with us. I pop in and do, and so does Matt. We do little guest tutorials on there. So we're still have our hands in it. And I'm still the producer of it. But it's really, they're running the show now.
Very cool. Well, we've got some questions here from your publisher about what some of your readers would like to know. So I'd love to get to some of these questions. So they would like to know what you shoot with when you go out on a shoot and what equipment you use to get the best shots and why. But can you go into a little bit about that?
Oh, sure. Well, I'll give you what I use the most because I do a lot of traveling with my family and for business, and I've gotten to the point where I used to drag all this gear. I used to take this big bag full of stuff.
Oh, we all did, honey.
And I'm over that now. So I take one body and one lens, and I leave it on the whole time. So for my last two trips, I just came back from 10 days in Greece and Italy and then 10 days in Maine, and I used one body and one camera, never changed lenses, never changed bodies, just that was it. I shoot an Nikon D3S for my body, which is a full-frame sensor, same sensor that's in the D700. So the reason I use the D3S mostly is for sports because I do shoot a lot of sports, but I'm just, average stuff is travel and stuff, like everyday fun stuff. And I use their brand new 28-300 lens. So I can go all the way from wide angle, way out to telephoto. It's not a super fast lens. It's, I think, f3.5 to 5.6. So when I'm wide, it's 3.5. When I'm zoomed into 300, it's 5.6. So it's not the greatest indoor lens, but because I'm on a D3S and the noise is incredibly low, if I need to crank up the noise to 4,000 ISO, which I do routinely, you don't even see the noise. So that's great. But the thing about that lens is it is a tack sharp lens. It's a fabulously sharp lens. It's one of the sharpest Nikon lenses I own. I don't know how they can be for the price because it's less than $1,000 or right around $1,000. So for a lens these days, that's a bargain, that's terrible to even say that, but it's true. So that's my main gig for like traveling and everyday stuff. And,
but it sounds like it's mostly your outdoor. That's more outdoor, or is that something you would also use indoors?
No, I'll shoot it anywhere because I can raise the ISO on that camera. Now, you can't do that on every camera, which is, the Nikon D3S and the D700 have insane low noise quality. I shoot NFL football games at 4,000 ISO all day long, and you never would know.
It's amazing.
So it is. I'll shoot a night game outdoors at 4,000 ISO, and people are like, I don't see any noise. It's because you don't. I don't even run any noise reduction on it. So that particular camera, that's its claim to fame. That's why people buy it. That's why people spend $5,000 on it, because there's no noise. I mean, it's like amazing. So that's the rig. Now, I use another rig for sports, and in the studio I use same body, but I change to a 70-200 f2.8 lens, which I think is a wonderful lens for portraits in the studio, and I shoot out towards the 200 end of it because I like the
impression. And what do you like about that lens?
Well, it's super sharp, but I think it's very, very sharp, and I love the way it looks at the 200-millimeter range. Like when you get out to 175 to 200, I think it really, really looks good. I could certainly even use the other lens. I hadn't really even thought about it until you said that. I'm thinking, because the 2.8, you don't get to use that in the studio because, you have studio lighting. You're mostly shooting at f11. You're not going to be shooting at f2.8. But, I could just as easily shoot with that one. I guess it's because I never want to shoot wide angle in the studio. I don't ever shoot wide angle. I'm always shooting pretty tight.
Yep.
So I guess I never thought to use that one because I would not use anything from 28 all the way to almost 200. So,
right. Well, there you go. I mean, that's very good insight for some of the newbies out there. They're also curious about your workflow. So it sounds like you don't use a Lightroom because you're a digital man and you're very current with, everything. You've got a great Twitter feed with just your name, at Scott Calby. So are you using sort of Camera Raw? What do you like about, in terms of your workflow and your process, How did you come up with it based on likes and dislikes? And another question kind of built in there that maybe you can address at the same time is, what do you wish Adobe might build into programs or upgrade so that it would make your workflow easier?
Fair enough. I do most of my work in Lightroom. So I use 80% of my time is spent in Lightroom, 20% in Photoshop. So I try to do as much as I can in Lightroom because it's so much quicker. It's just, and it drives me crazy that I run into people at my seminars that go, isn't Lightroom just a replacement for the Bridge and Camera Raw? And I'm just like, oh, you poor person. Well, here's why I think about the Bridge. You know, the Bridge. We have a saying about the Bridge. There's a reason why it's free. Because it sucks. So I did a series of videos with Matt Kloskowski. We did 100 videos called Why Lightroom Kicks the Bridge's Ass. And so your listeners can go see it at PhotoshopUser.com/Lightroom. And there's 100 videos, each one of them 1 minute long or less, that we just show here's why Lightroom's better. And you'll get to about the third video, and you'll switch. You'll go, you'll hit the buy button, and you'll buy Lightroom because it's a world away. It's not just a little better. It's not just it does replace the Bridge and Camera Raw, but it does so much more. So, I'm a pretty diehard Lightroom, and so that's my workflow. Is if I'm in the studio, I shoot tethered right directly into Lightroom. So I go from the camera straight into Lightroom, so I see the pictures
nice
and big.
I love that.
Yeah, they come in like 8x10s instead of 3 inches. From there, I Camera Raw is built into Lightroom, so I do my tweaking and adjusting there. And if I'm lucky, that's the end of the process. I go straight to the web or make a print from there. If I'm not lucky and I need to do some retouching or something a little more deep, then there's a keyboard shortcut in Lightroom. It's Command-E on Mac or Control-E on PC that takes the file I'm working on and sends it directly to Photoshop. I can do whatever I want to do in Photoshop, as many things as I want to do. And when I'm done, all I do is hit save and close, and it goes back to Lightroom. So it's kind of a round-trip workflow.
That's
I start
very
in
nice.
Lightroom, do as much as I can. If I have to go to Photoshop,
go
I jump over, and it comes right back. Okay, so what would I add to Photoshop or Lightroom to really, really make it better?
Or recommendation for Adobe. I mean, honestly, you know, for those techies out there that – would love to, you know, hear recommendations.
I'm going to actually pull up something here for you because I'm going to cheat if you don't mind. But I wrote a thing called What I'd Like to See in Lightroom 4. So I'm going
to
pull it up here.
Oh, you have to send me the link, and I'll put it on my blog post.
That would be good. All right, let me just find it here. Lightroom 4, and I got to put it in quotes.
So you've got a whole post on recommendations. That's great. So we can...
Oh, yeah.
Send people over to my website, which is jenniferneely.com, and we'll have a post about the show, and that'll be one of the recommended links there to check out.
All right. I found it. Okay.
Fabulous.
So there it is. So this will just jog my memory for me. Okay, the biggies. All right. So here's the biggie things. I want to see the ability to be able to create photo books directly inside of Lightroom. The reason is because I have to have Apple's Aperture 3 on my computer just so I can make photo books. So I do all my editing in Lightroom. I save them as JPEGs. I import them into Aperture. And there's two things I actually do in Aperture. Number one is I make photo books. The other is make slideshows because their slideshows are great, and you can sync to the music and all this different stuff. There's just tremendously better. Their slideshow just kicks the other ones. But also, there are decent type controls. So the type controls in Photoshop are wonderful. The type controls in Lightroom stink. They make the Bridge look like a good program. We need some basic video editing. We need to be able to, like the DSLR video that we shoot, let us just do basic edits. I don't need a whole big program. I don't want to learn a whole big program. But let me drop my videos on a timeline with a title and a dissolve and save it. I don't want soft proofing, but so many people do, so I'm going to leave that one off my list. Everybody asks for a networked copy of Lightroom. I don't know if we're ever going to see it without them having to rebuild it from scratch. But that's a big one for a lot of people. I'd love to see built-in HDR. That would be lovely. Mm-hmm. A better one than in Photoshop CS5. Photoshop CS5 is actually pretty good, but it could be better. So that would be it. And automated backup, you know, just back up all my stuff. People have such a hard time backing up. And I got a million little stinking stupid things, but those are the big ones.
It's always that. for me, it's like when they change the tools in Photoshop, I go nuts. Like when they change the tool presets. I've been used to like a certain set of tools that I use religiously, and I might make one change, and change up the order so it opens up the same way every time. But if I'm paying to upgrade to a new version, I want it to remember or know, or at least have the same presets. I only have to change out the one thing. Because, if my paint bucket goes away or my like eyedropper tool, if those go away, I'm hosed.
No, and that stuff like that drives people crazy, like on a level you can't believe. So,
it's the little things. So now
it is. It's always the little things.
It's always the little things. I totally agree with you. So, for readers, so I guess if one of your readers told you they're just starting out in their career, they're brand new,
mm-hmm.
what single piece of advice might you offer him or her as they get started as a digital photographer?
Oh well. Now, so let me just clarify the question. Are you asking, I'm getting started, I want to do this as my living, or I'm just getting started in photography? Like, I just bought a digital camera, what should I do first?
Let's cover off on both scenarios. So let's say someone comes up to you on the street, and they're kind of vague, and we'll assume that you had asked them that clarifying question. Would it be for, personal, or is this more for, for something that you want to actually grow into your career or become your career?
Okay, I would say that we'll do the personal one first. Okay, so if someone said, I just got a DSLR and I want to get serious about photography, what should I do? I would say, I think a lot of people think that the good photograph is waiting inside a menu in their camera, that somewhere inside all those menus is going to be a button or a setting they turn on or a preference that all of a sudden makes them get great for photographs. I really think that because I see people that are so passionate about figuring out every little nuance of their camera and tweaking it, and then I look at their pictures and I'm like, oh my God, the last thing you need to be doing is digging in those things. What I would tell people to do is really look at the photography that you admire. Figure out what it is that you like about it. Look at a lot of other people's stuff and then try to emulate what they do.
So it's like a style,
player.
Developing kind of a style.
Yeah,
and you have to start with
other people's stuff. Yeah, you have to start with their stuff first. If you're a guitar player, I'm a guitar player, but it's a hobby, not a keyboard player by trade. So I played many years keyboards in a band, but I play guitar for fun.
The wedding singer. You can add that to the list.
No. Cool bands, not stuff like that.
All right.
Okay, I did play a wedding or two, but I would never admit it. Okay.
There we go.
So,
okay.
So here's the deal. So when you're learning guitar, every guitar player I've ever known in my entire life, you learn by copying solos off the record of all of your favorite guitar players. You learn all their licks. You learn all their notes, note for note.
Well, and it's also sort of part of your question, too. I play guitar, too. Electric, I would assume you're talking about electric, but electric versus acoustic, right?
Yeah.
Or amped
right.
acoustic, and if the action high
Okay, let's just say lead guitar. How's that?
We'll
just make it very, very, lead guitar. So you copy and you learn all your favorite songs. And then eventually you start to paste them all together, and then all of a sudden you've created your own style based on learning all that stuff. But you learned all that stuff first. And you're just copying somebody else's stuff note for note for note. But then you realize, hey, what if I take this one note and this note and that note and I can create my own thing? And that doesn't happen on day one. I think that with photography you can do somewhat the same thing. Go copy Joe McNally's style. Go copy somebody else's style. Find the people that you love and do their stuff. And then, but all their stuff doesn't come from a bunch of settings in the camera. It comes from how they composed it, the light that they shot it in, things like that. I think that's what I would say is stop focusing on all the technology. Look at the people that you want to be like. Copy their style, and then your style will emerge out of that. And if the worst thing that ever happens to you is somebody goes, oh, that guy, his stuff looks just like Joe McNally. Is that the worst thing that ever happened? That somebody compared you to one of the best photographers in the world? Oh,
well,
his stuff looks just like Joe McNally's.
Yeah,
that would be a great compliment
when you go
to me.
Through any exhibit of great photography, I love, sort of nature photography. And I was with a bunch of people in Vegas. We're looking at Peter Licks
Oh, his stuff's crazy, yeah.
And right, but everybody, you know, is going, oh my God, look at how that's photoshopped, and they did this and they did that, but it's still great photography. It sells like crazy, you know. I mean, that's the technology that's available. So it sounds like you're someone who is an adopter of that, and it doesn't, you know, that doesn't. It's just the quality of the output, right?
Yeah. Hey, I walked through his gallery. He's got a gallery in Vegas and stuff and all.
Yeah,
and his
that's
stuff
what
looks fantastic, and I don't care whether he used Photoshop or not. He says he doesn't. That it's darkroom or whatever, but I've heard people, you know, argue that point. I don't care whether he did or not. He produces beautiful stuff that people want to spend thousands of dollars to hang in their home. Story over.
Yep,
doesn't matter how you got there. It's art. It's art. What does it matter whether you use charcoal or acrylic or oil or a camera or Photoshop or whatever? It's art. And if people are willing to line up to pay $5,000 a print, whatever you're doing, you need to do more of it. So my hat's off to him.
That segues nicely into what you would give as advice to the budding professional photographer.
Okay. So when you go to his gallery, you've been to his have you been to his gallery?
Yep, in Vegas.
Okay. Okay. And what
in
did
the
you
Venetian,
see in there?
In the Venetian,
right,
in the Palazzo.
Yeah. Yeah, I see it over at he's got one at Caesars too. So what did you see in his gallery? What kind of photos?
Oh, gosh. I mean, just so it's nature photography. So
okay, landscapes.
Lots of beautiful. Yeah, and just like the richness of a lot of them have.
Right.
Some of them have water. Some of them have these beautiful, like, adobe.
Right.
I mean, he's Australian, so there's a lot of beautiful sort of outback. Reminds me of parts of California, though, you know, sort of that adobe-style homes of, you know, Spanish architecture from way back in the day, and you know.
Did he have any pictures of people?
I don't remember any people in that gallery.
Did he have any architecture?
I think yes, there were. There were a couple bridges.
Right. Well, but no, that still comes under landscape. So it's not a building.
No, I don't think there were. It was the only thing I remember,
sports?
And I'm remembering what I liked, obviously. So
right, but sports? Did you see any sports?
No.
So my point here is every shot in there looks like he took it, and it's all the same topic.
Yeah, it definitely has a style. Yep.
Absolutely. You could look at one of his shots and go, oh, that's his.
His.
If you put a person there, you go, what the hell is that? If he had a product shot or something, you'd go, what's that doing here? And that would be my advice to someone who's starting out as a professional. Nobody wants a photographer that can shoot everything, because every photographer can shoot whatever. The people that are seen to be making it these days are the people that have a very, very obvious style. I don't care whether they do it in post-processing, whether they do it later in Photoshop, whether they do it the way they frame their shots, whether they do it in camera. But the photographers that are making it, you can look at one of their shots and go, oh, that's a Bob Johnson. That's a Phil Smith. That's a Joe McNally. That's a Moose Peterson.
Do you feel like you could do that with Russell Brand?
With Russell Brand? The actor?
The Victoria's Secret. No, what is his name? The guy that does all the Victoria's Secret photography.
Oh, no, I thought Russell Brand, isn't he the actor that married...
He's an actor. I'm saying the name wrong. I'll look him up. Hang on while we're sitting here.
That guy has a look, right? And every time you see one of those photos, you go, oh, that's him. So what clients want these days is to be able to go, I want that look. I want this particular thing. They don't go, you know what? I just want anything. If you just want anything, you can get any photographer to do it.
Russell James. Russell James.
There you go. Right. Russell Brand, different guy. Okay.
Yeah.
But you know what you see what I'm saying? Is that if you have a specialty, you know, people will they won't, maybe not everybody hires you, but somebody will go, ooh, that guy's got the look I want, and you'll get the gig.
And I think that's synonymous. They can with a brand
exactly. Right. People want a particular look, and the people that can deliver a particular look are working. And everybody else on weekends is shooting weddings. So and everybody's shooting weddings. If I run into a sports photographer, what are you doing this weekend? Well, I got a game Saturday, and then Saturday night I'm shooting a wedding, and then I'm shooting a basketball game on Sunday, and then I'm shooting a wedding. And so everybody, whatever they're doing, whatever, I mean, landscape photographers, there's no money in it. The only guy making it is Peter Lick, right? So there's not like a real market for landscape photographers. You know, there's not like somebody that's going to hire you to do landscape photography.
But you probably wouldn't say that to the person on the street that walks up to you after reading your book and saying, you know, I really want to make it. You'd say, develop that personal style.
Yeah, That's what I would
and
say.
What else would you say? Is there anything else you would want to break out for them?
No, I mean that's really it. Is you know, if you really want to make a living today, everybody shoots photography.
Be iconic.
Yeah, everybody shoot. There's nobody. I mean, everybody. I mean, when you go to a wedding today, and let's say that you're a photographer at a wedding, you're not the only person shooting that wedding. You'll see 25 DSLRs shooting the same wedding at a wedding with 200 people.
Yeah,
they'll
absolutely
ask you as the wedding photographer to get out of the way so they can get a shot.
Well, it's sort of like, I mean, it's become so, I mean, the thing that kind of proves the point of what you're saying is that, you know, like David LaChapelle is complaining, is saying that Rihanna's photo shoot is actually infringing on his intellectual property because of the way the shoot was conducted. That's how iconic his photography is.
Right,
so
you can say that's
that
my look, right.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, if it can be made
right
into a lawsuit.
Right. So I'm not saying whether he's right or wrong or, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
neither am I. But I mean, the fact that it can even be not thrown out of court, right? It's still.
Right.
But he has
a look that is very identifiable as him, so much so that he felt he had a case. Then you'd go, well, yeah, that's his kind of look or whatever.
Yeah,
or at least that's what he's hoping
right
the jury
away.
Will say.
Yeah,
right,
it'll
so,
be interesting.
So that would be, those would be the two things that I would tell anybody if they said,
so
hey,
now,
go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to take you on a time trip. So if putting your – there you go. Very good soundtrack, actually.
Thank you.
You were that person and you were going up to someone and asking for advice, what is the one thing that you know now that you wish you would have known when you started shooting?
Develop a style. Now, I'm in a different situation. I do shoot sports professionally, but I don't have to really compete. I'm an educator. So I'm not having to compete with other photographers in my area.
But is there anything that you wish you had known?
I wish I had known not to get so focused on the crap inside the camera. Because I think, like, you get a camera and you spend the first couple of months just trying to, I know there's a button in here. It's just like
it's the menu setting thing you were talking about.
Yeah. Do you know that when people go to the Epson Print Academy, the guy that runs the Epson Print Academy tells me that when he reads the evaluation forms at the end of the day, people complain, you didn't show me enough about the printer, because they think there's a secret button that makes great prints in the back, and that the pros know where it is, but they never showed it, and they were very disappointed. But the fact of the matter is, there's only three things you can do with the printer. You plug it in, you put the ink cartridges in, you put the paper in, and then you send a print to it. And he goes, they think that there's this other secret thing that we're not telling them. You know, there's plenty to do in Photoshop to make the print. That's where the print is really made. But printers don't have a secret button that go, okay, welcome to the Epson Print Academy. You've wanted to know where it is. There's a special tool that unlocks pro print quality. But I think that people think the exact same thing about their camera. I'm going to find a button that changes everything, that all of a sudden my stuff's going to look great. And so that's kind of, you know, I went through that phase myself. I went through thinking, you know what, there's got to be something in here. And it wasn't something in there. It was me. So I wish I'd gotten to that a little earlier. And, you know, I came to this in such a, you know, a different path. Back when I started shooting, it was really hard. I mean, everything was hard. And you spent a lot of money on film and a lot of money in processing. And you'd have whole rolls that you thought were going to be brilliant that were just awful. And things were out of focus, and, you know, there was just terrible things that you only learned after the fact, that it was a real blood and guts. I don't think that people should go through that. I know that there are art teachers teaching black and white processing to this very day, which makes me cringe. You might as well be teaching kids cursive in school, since they're never, ever,
I feel
ever
like that about certain elements of technology. Trust me, I'm with you.
Oh, yeah. So it's like when like, you know, I have a young daughter, and they're teaching her cursive, and I'm like, outside of signing her name, when is she ever going to use cursive? But for goodness sakes, don't teach her computer. Don't teach her the tools she'll be using her entire life. Let's focus on cursive. Okay, that's
a whole
different story.
And if they do, the only thing they teach them is PowerPoint. But anyway.
I know. They need to teach them how to actually maintain their computer, because half our company has to call IT people.
Yeah.
If anybody taught them how to maintain their computer, they'd just be fixing it themselves. And they're all mad at the IT people who actually did learn how to do this stuff. Okay, but back to our story. I guess that's what it was. I mean, if somebody had given me a heads up, it would be like, this is a really, really, really hard job. The hardest part is marketing yourself. It is not the camera controls. You'll spend 10% of your time shooting and 90% trying to make a living. So focus on the other stuff. Come up with a style. Come up with things that are marketable. Learn business. Learn the business side of photography, because you're going to shoot so little. You won't be sitting in your studio shooting every single day, all day long, with clients just pouring in the door. Your job will be spent mostly trying to get clients to pour in the door.
So now you're the president of the Trade Association for Adobe Photoshop Users, NAPP.
Yes.
So how did that come about?
It came out of the seminars. So we were doing these seminars, going around the country teaching Photoshop. We'd go to a town. We'd go to, let's say, Dallas, Texas. People come up and go, man, what a great day. This is awesome. When are you guys coming back? And I'd be like, next year. And they go, well, what do we do between now and then? I don't know. Maybe go to a website or something. And we realized after going to cities all over the country that there was no central resource for learning about Photoshop all year long. So we went to Adobe and came up with the idea to do this association. And we, had to get Adobe's blessing, because you're using their name, Photoshop. Mm-hmm. And so they did. They gave us their blessing and a license, and we can start this association, and we did. And now we have like 74,000 members around the world in 102 different countries.
That is fantastic. I think that's a great story for, you know, especially for trying to create standards or a way of positively, you know, providing feedback to an organization that really is a huge part of an industry. That's a really great piece. Now, in terms of being an author, you've written more than 50 books, which is just incredible to me. And you've won the Benjamin Franklin Award. Let's let the listeners know a little bit about when you won the award, what you won it for, and what it means to you.
Yeah, I don't even really mention that award anymore. It wasn't. It was a design award, so it's for independent publishers coming together and say, "Hey, your book looks really great." I have so many awards I like better than that one. That was kind of. I don't know. Can't believe it's still in my bio. But anyway. But
what awards are you really proud of?
Well, I'm most proud of the award that I won this past year. So, it wasn't an award. It was more of a distinction, I guess. So for 6 years in a row, I was the world's number one computer and technology author. So The way they do books, they put photography books under computer and technology. So my Photoshop books and my Lightroom books, and then finally my photography books were all lumped in there. But then eventually they removed photography out into its own separate category. So it was completely separate. And when that happened, as it turned out, because I sell a lot of books on photography, I wound up last year as the number two most best-selling computer author. Last year I was the number two photography author.
You were actually number one. According to PitchPit,
That was
for
the year
2010.
Before. So for 2009, I was number two. The guy that beat me is not very good. His name's Ansel Adams, and I thought he was kind of a hack. Okay, so Ansel Adams kicked my butt, but I thought, hey, who cares? It's Ansel Adams.
Well, Adams, you know, right.
I'm thinking, if I have to lose somebody, Ansel Adams isn't the worst guy to lose. At least I'm in good company. But they also count his calendars, because his calendars are sold in bookstores. So
exactly.
I was like, well, still, hey, I don't care. I'm number two to Ansel Adams. But this year, here's what I'm psyched about. In 2010, I beat him. So I actually sold more books. No one's more surprised than me, believe me, when they told me. So here's how they told me. I'm on a photo shoot in Denver. I get a call from my editor, PeachBit, and he says, hey, Scott, look, I've got good news and bad news. Which do you want? Okay, I'll take the bad news. You're not the number one computer author for this year. I'm like, there's good news? Because that seems kind of bad, because it's been 6 years in a row. He said, but you are, this year, the number one best-selling photography author. And to me, computer book author sounds like a nerdy thing. Like, you know, it doesn't sound cool.
It sounds geeky, that's for sure.
It sounds a tad geeky. And so, photography author sounds cool, and it sounds cooler than I am. So I'm happy. I'm not as geeky as a computer author, but I'm not quite as cool as best-selling photography author. I'm in that gray area in between. So that was the one I'm excited about. That was, for me, a really big deal, and it was very unexpected. I just thought, you know, I'm never going to catch him. But somehow in some crazy way.
Well, 50 books later, it happened. And that's a huge testament to your ability to train people well. You know, you mentioned your editor, and it's always interesting as we celebrate the 25th anniversary of Peach Pit Press, how you got involved in the Peach Pit publishing community in the first place.
Oh, well, it's kind of an interesting story. So my very first book that I wrote, I published, self-published. It's called Photoshop Down and Dirty Tricks. And I self-published, and I didn't know any better, right? So this is going back many years. And so we hired a local printer, and we sold it to people at my seminars. And then there was a time, and you can still do it to this day, but Amazon.com would actually sell your books as an independent publisher. I sent Amazon like 20 books and saw how it would go, and they sold them immediately. And they said, now we'll take 50, and then now we'll take 100. Now we'll take 300. We're like, oh, my gosh. It was like all of a sudden it just went crazy.
Wow, and meeting a need. When was this?
Oh, gosh, 1990-something.
Yeah, there you go.
98, 99 maybe, something like that.
Well, and that's a very key time because, you know, being in the Bay Area, the Silicon Valley's dot boom was in high gear. So a lot of people like me, that's when I was starting to learn all of this. You know, I was learning, Flash, when Flash changed all the time. I remember all the books. Every time a new version came out, you needed a new book because it was like an entirely new program.
Oh, yeah.
So that made a lot of sense.
Was great. So what happened was the book just went insane. And so Peach Pit actually came to me at a trade show, and they said, we want to make you an offer, to publish your books instead. And I'm like, ooh, I don't know. This self-publishing thing is pretty good. But they were able to make a deal and a case to me that made me say, okay, I will do this and reach a bigger market and all these things. And it's worked out wonderfully well. We have a great partnership to this very day. And I have a wonderful editor. So my editor is a guy named Ted Waite, and I don't really like him, but he's who was assigned to me. No, he's wonderful. I've got the coolest editor. No, he really is. I mean, he's I will say this, that the thing about Peach Pit that I like the best about them, because I've been working with them now 12 years or 11 years, whatever it is. So every time there's been a point where we had to make a decision based on what's the right thing for for the reader, they always, always, always go with it. They never want to shortchange. I mean, I think they really understand that the most important thing is that you write a great book. That's what they're real. And I think very often, I think that from, I guess, the reader's perspective, they think so many decisions are based on money and, you had to write a certain number of pages because your publisher made you and all. My publisher doesn't make me do anything. They don't say, Scott, this next book has to be 300 pages. They ask me, how many pages do you think it's going to be? And unfortunately, I've had to call them in numerous cases and go, yeah, it's going to be another 50, which is bad for them because they have to buy the paper up front, right? Because they're dealing in huge numbers, and so they have to leverage and stuff. So I've gotten them in trouble sometimes. But they don't go, no, Scott, take those 50 pages out. We have a deal. They're like, is that what the book needs to be? And I say, yep. And they go, then that's what the book needs to be. So that's one of the things that I think is a tremendous testament to them, is that they really want to make great books. I really, really, truly believe in my heart that their whole business model is based on that. If we make really, really great books, we'll sell a ton of books. If we start not making great books, and I had to tell them something really, really harsh this year. So I'd planned on writing my digital photography book, Volume 4. And as you mentioned, the digital photography book series, the Volume 1 is the biggest selling book in the history of digital photography. And I have Volume 2 and Volume 3, and it was time for Volume 4. And it'd been on, and they've gone and sold this concept to all the bookstores. They've gone and sold it to Barnes & Noble and to Amazon and to every independent bookstore in the world. Hey, we're going to have this book, and it's going to come on this date. And so I start to write the book, and I put my outline together, and I realize, I don't have enough tips to fill this book with enough stuff that I would feel good about it. In other words, I need 200-page, it's a 200-page book, so I need literally – there's one tip per page. I need 200 really good photography techniques to be able to give that to Peach Pit. And when I added them up, I had like 85. And I had to call them and go, guys, I hate to tell you this, but there's not a book here. I can't fill it with a bunch of fluff because it will kill the series. No one will ever want to buy one again if I put out a really crappy one.
Yeah, so, it'd be like a flip book.
And so I know this puts you guys in a terrible situation. I mean, this is going to, you know, it's going to make readers unhappy. It's going to make, you know, booksellers unhappy. I know it's going to make you guys unhappy. But I don't have this book in me. It's just I don't know enough to put it in there. Now, you know, give me some more time to come up with really, really good stuff because I want Volume 4 to be as good as Volume 1. And they were totally cool with it. They weren't happy. They weren't like, oh, good, no. But they were like, you know what? We got it. You're doing the right thing. We got to do this. We have to maintain the integrity of the series. I mean, they were totally cool with it. And I know they were dying. I know that they were like, oh, my God. I got to call the booksellers. We had our convention, and this was our big book of the year, and now you're telling me we're not getting our big book of the year? And they were totally cool with it.
That's awesome. Unfortunately, we're all out of time. I could talk to you forever. You are so easy to talk to, Scott.
Oh, well, you're very kind. Thanks. You're not so bad yourself there.
Hey, thanks. So we should let people know that they can learn more about the history of Peach Pit Press on its website at peachpit.com. And I want to thank you, Scott, so much for joining us on this special show celebrating the 25th anniversary of Peach Pit Press.
Yay. Well, thank you, Jennifer. I had a really great time. Thanks for all the cool questions.
I'm so glad.
And I
you're
babbled like mad, so I'm sorry I did babble.
But it's
because I was drinking, and if I hadn't been drinking, it'd been like a lot more concise.
Don't tell your daughter's teacher who's teaching cursive.
No.
That might continue. All right. Well, we'll let you get on with your afternoon. Thank you so much.
All right, my pleasure. Thanks.
And send that link over, and I'll get it on my blog.
I'm doing it right now. Here I go.
Fabulous. Thanks so much, Scott.
All right. Bye bye.
And for you listeners, we hope you enjoyed the program. Please feel free to embed, download, or otherwise share the show. And join us tomorrow for another special Peach Pit 25th anniversary show at noon Pacific. And my guest will be the icon of Mac, or many call her a Mac icon, Robin Williams. She joins us again tomorrow at noon Pacific. So I hope you'll join us back at that time, same place. And thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.